Hey, what up? Welcome into the All Ball Podcast. Listen, we're not going to do trade deadline stuff on the All Ball Podcast. Not because it's not important. You have the Doug Gottlieb Show podcast, where when news breaks, you know, I got an interview with Sam Amick you can download and where he thinks people are going. And when the trade deadline's done, we'll go through it. Then we have the buyout stuff. Like, that's more kind of this one. Well, look, Rajah Bell's been a friend of mine for, God, how old am I now? 15 years, maybe. And I, in many ways, revere him because from humble beginnings, you know, he went to BU, then to Florida International, then, like me, kind of bounced around minor league basketball to making it in the league. Like, he made it. And it wasn't just he made it, then become a starter, and then he became a fire starter with Kobe Bryant. So I've wanted to have him on for a long time. And I wanted him to tell a story, but then, you know, the Kobe tragedy happens and I wanted to have him on for that. So this is a long one. It's a good one. It has kind of intertwined his life, career, and when he became this thorn in Kobe's side, and kind of has a surprise ending. So there's a lot to it. So without further ado, here's part one.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
All right, let's welcome him in. He's Rajah Bell. Rajah, how are you?
Doug, I'm good, baby. How are you?
Good. Look, I actually have an additional pod about your career because I think it's amazing. I mean, in all candor, right? Like, you and I... I mean, like, you went from USBL to NBA to you know, the Kobe stopper. But I just think in terms of timeliness, I want to talk Kobe. Are you cool with that?
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
All right. For people who don't remember your story, you grew up where?
I grew up in the Virgin Islands until I was about 13, and then I moved to Miami, so... I did my middle school, most of it, and high school in the Miami area. And before that, it was on a small island in the Caribbean playing tennis.
Playing tennis? I didn't know you played tennis. That's fascinating. I played a little tennis for a couple of years. My son plays some tennis. It's an incredible sport. We should have played when I was in Miami. Totally should have played.
It's a great footwork sport. Great footwork sport.
And, by the way, I was at your campus on Saturday at FIU. They play in the ocean, but they got a cool kind of hangout area during games, right? Where they got bottle service and everything. Not that there was bottle service needed on a noon game, but they actually got a nice little squad. They got the big kids. I think he can make the league.
Listen, yeah, that kid went undrafted. I mean, not undrafted. He went unrecruited. He walked on at FIU.
He quit his high school team.
It's ridiculous, but it's part of the issue with FIU. You got me on a hot topic now. They actually have been pointing in the right direction, and Coach Ballard and company have put together a nice squad. But prior to that, they were completely under recruiting our own backyard, and they were going everywhere else looking for this talent. And part of the problem in Miami is grassroots wise, you don't have great teachers of the game. But it's never been about not having the athletes. So if you're good at teaching the game and you can get kids in and help them understand conceptually, you know, what you're trying to do and teach a little bit, well, then the athletes are already here. And they missed out on so many of those kids that went and wound up being player of the year in other conferences that it was a laughable thing. It's actually pretty cool to see them doing well. I hate the court, by the way. Like, I don't love the ocean and the cabana look, but – I know what they're going for, but it's pretty cool to see them playing good basketball.
Yeah, I would say this. I don't like that one side because you can't tell. There's just too many lines. You can't tell where the three-point line is. I do think when you're at a school like FIU, having something like that, right? Something that pops anytime it's on TV, I do think is a good thing. Like, is that a crazy way to look at it?
No, I think you're absolutely right. It's why I would say that I understand what you're going for. Like, I get it. I just don't love it. And maybe it's because, you know, I don't go through day-to-day what FIU goes through in terms of having to explain to people who we are, you know? So, like, for me, it's almost like, come on, man, like, we don't need that. But we do need that. So I understand what you're going for. I don't love it, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's I had the pronunciation really good Saturday. It's Osagai, right? Is that how you say his last name? Osagai. Anyway,
yeah,
he's 6'9", 250. He leads the country in block shots. They use him perfectly, by the way. They're running NBA stuff, spread, pick, and roll in the slot, and he's awesome. And, I mean, like, look, for people who haven't seen him, like, we're giving away, like, little this is what an NBA big looks like. And when the new staff got there, when Jeremy Ballard got there, like, the previous staff didn't want to keep him, and he was going to quit. And they talked him into staying, put him on scholarship, and now he's the best shot blocker in the country. It's insane. Absolutely insane.
It's a ridiculous story. We went to watch him. I would take my boys down, and we'd see the kid sitting there in street clothes, or playing, you know, when he was dressed, you know, playing the regular 2 or 3 minutes that they'd give him. There would be no reason to know that he could play just because no one ever gave him a shot to play. It's pretty crazy. The kid Antonio Day, I don't know if you saw him.
Yeah, I like him.
What they do. He's really good guard.
He's only 18 years old, too. And so he got a chance.
He's got a chance. He played locally in high school, like up in the area that I live in. And, you know, a mutual friend of ours was like, look, this kid really wants to go to FIU. Could you call the school? And it wasn't Ballard at the time. It was the old coach. And I was like, look, you got a kid. You have to check him out. Like, I think he'd be a good fit. Athletically, FIUs of the world don't get a look at a kid like this. Not to mention that he's just really gifted in pick and roll and can really run what they're trying to run right now. But I think he's got a chance too, Doug. He's got a body. He is freaky athletic. I'm reluctant to say Ja Morant because Ja is like a 0.001 percentile, but this kid is a super freaky athlete also, and he's really good in pick and roll.
Okay, so I know actually it's getting ready to do the game. You know, you prep. I don't know if you know this story. His dad was shot and killed like 5 days before he was born. And he's originally from Raleigh. Yeah, this is Antonio Day Jr. For people who don't know, he's a sophomore at FIU, and Jeremy Ballard's doing a really good job there. Anyway, so, and he's a young sophomore, and who people understand, like, I was a holdback, so I graduated high school at 19. He's a sophomore, he's only 18, so he's still developing his game. He's 6'1", 188 or so, 190, built like a brick shit house, and a really good, they've made him into a really good ball screen guard, and he can defend. I would say, you know, he's got to shoot the ball better. But he should be able to defend 94 feet to get to the basket, and he's excellent in what they do in spread ball screen stuff, which is all really you do in the NBA. Anyway, so his dad was shot and killed before he's born, and then he grew up in Raleigh, and I think only his junior or senior year, he moved down to Fort Lauderdale and went to high school there. Huh?
Doug, we tried to get... I was working at a local high school. One of my good friends coaches there, and so I was... you know, helping, trying to figure out if I like to do it. So I was helping. And this kid, someone said, hey, man, we got a kid moved down from North Carolina. You got to check him out. The first time I saw him, I was like, what? What are you talking about? This kid isn't, he's not in college somewhere? They're like, look, he's like playing 15U Under Armour. And he's a junior, but he's playing 15U because he's a baby. And even at that point, you were like, this, physically, he's different. And a really nice kid, like a really good kid. I had no idea about the dad and the backstory there. But I remember when he moved to town because we hadn't seen anything like him here in the Fort Lauderdale area.
Yeah, they have a really good staff there. Ballard, David Quezon's there, and then Joey Rodriguez. Remember, he played at VCU. Of course, Ballard was at VCU twice over, and they got a good staff of guys to work with guards too. The whole thing is, and I know that Ballard leaves, he'd take him with him. But that's a good little crew they have there. Anyway, all right, let's get to that's the most anyone will ever talk on a pod about FIU, but I wasn't pleasantly surprised. I was kind of blown away by those two because I could honestly see both those guys having a shot to play in the league, which is I never thought I would have said before I threw on tape and then I saw them in person.
Right.
Okay, so like you don't have it's interesting because I didn't. You backing up now? You talking to me in the car? You're on Bluetooth? Like, all right, make sure you don't hit whatever you're backing up.
Go ahead. All right. So, put it apart. Go.
No, you're good. You can do whatever you got to do. It's okay. So, like, you're going through the rigors of minor league basketball, right? What was, and Kobe was younger than us. What was your first memory of the name Kobe Bryant was when?
It would have been, was it 95, 96, one of those years. I was already a freshman at Boston University. I played that year. So it was probably the summer of 95 or 96. It all blends together at this point. But I had some teammates from the Northeast area. Like, you know, we had Long Island was represented, and we had, you know, a bunch of kids from New Hampshire. And so there were, you know, a lot of guys who knew that Northeast. And the Boston Shootout was coming to town. And so, you know, you had a lot of guys coming in to play. A lot of big names were there. Like, Steph was coming, and Paul Pierce had a team in there. BABC had these great teams. And all my teammates were like, you got to see this kid named Kobe Bryant. And I was like, well, where is he from? Like, I wasn't tuned in or plugged in like that. But we went over to Boston College to try to watch him play. I'm not even sure that he played that game. But when I got there, the arena was just smashed. And this was before, you know, Bronny plays on TV and you have, you know, thousands of people fill in like Target Center or whatever it is. Now this was pre all of that. Everybody had lined up to see, you know, Kobe Bryant, whether he was going to dress out or not. And that was my first introduction to Kobe. I was like, man, this guy, this name alone carries a lot of weight. Now, he didn't play that day, and I didn't get to see him play in a tournament, but I started following him after that. And then, you know, obviously, you know, when he hit the league and the glimpses in his just his rookie season alone, when he was able to get out there, you know, you could tell that was the force they weren't going to be able to hold back for very long.
So then, okay, you go to FIU. You get done at FIU. So you transferred, right? You went up to FIU because they had, you went up to BU because Frank was there?
No, when I went to BU, it was Brett Brown's dad, Bob Brown. And the story on that, I mean, look, I was a young senior, so I was like 6'5", 175. And I had a good senior year, but I got recruited by a lot of mid-majors early. And when the majors started coming my senior year, I just was, Doug, I was a little, like, I was small, and I guess I didn't have the confidence that, so I wanted to play right away, and I didn't buy that Dale Brown was going to be able to play me at the three start in the SEC as a 180-pound freshman. So I chose BU, and I left there because, you know, Shaky Rodriguez got the job at FIU, and they wanted to lead the country in scoring, and I wanted to lead the country in scoring. It never worked out like that, but that's what I wanted to do.
Okay, so you come back home, you get done at FIU, and then what?
So, look, I didn't know what was going to happen. I had very little NBA interest. I picked my agent because he sat down with me, and he was brutally honest. He said, I saw a lot of players here at the Sun Belt Conference tournament. He was like, you were one of the better ones. I don't think you could play in the NBA, but I think I can make you some money in Europe. So I picked him just for the honesty. This was Bill McCandless at the time.
That was my guy. That was Bill. Yeah.
Bill's a good dude, right? So I appreciated that, the kind of slap in the face, but at least you're shooting me straight. And I had one workout with the Atlanta Hawks. Pete Babcock had seen me play in the Arizona tournament where we were brought in to be the cupcake for Penn State. And we beat Penn State, and they were supposed to see Arizona, but Arizona drew us then. And I went up against Jason Terry and Luke Walton and Richard Jefferson, and I had like 24, I think, and they fouled me out with like 4 minutes to go just to protect the win. And Pete was like, hey, man, I know, like, you're not going to Portsmouth and you're not going to go to Chicago, but we'll bring you in for a workout. So I went in and I worked out against Melvin Levitt, Quincy Lewis, and Chris Heron. Four-man workout at Georgia Tech. And I don't know what was going on that day, Doug, but like Melvin was known, you know, he's a helicopter. Like, I matched him on the vert that day. Like, I shot as well as Quincy did. And no BS, because I was never known for ball handling, but I probably handled it as well as Chris did. So the stars just aligned for me that day. They didn't draft me, although they said they'd take me with the last pick in the draft, but they invited me back to vet camp. Pre-vet camp, I spent time, obviously, in the USBL with the Tampa Bay Windjammers, traversing.
Hold on. Let's not gloss over that, because I know I want to make this about Kobe, but this is awesome. Okay, so just so you know, so McCandless, my deal with McCandless was he didn't get me any workouts. I went to the USBL, and he was like, "Look, dude, I'm gonna send guys to the USBL because it's an Oklahoma team. You'll play with some of your guys. You're kind of the guy there, whatever." A couple teams came and watched me, but I didn't. I was like, I was kind of pissed at Bill that he was just kind of shipping me overseas. I had an Israeli passport, whatever, you know, waiting for me. But I, so like for people who were, okay, so Melvin Levitt was the levitator, right? He was the one who had the nasty dunk, I think, to beat Duke in Alaska. So what was your vert to beat Melvin Levitt on that day? Do you remember?
I jumped 40 that day.
That's some boing. That's off a step or off a straight vert or off a run?
Off of one step. They gave me one step. So I took that one step, and I never tested. Like, FIU never tested anything. So I had no idea. I was just going in there trying to make something out of this little opportunity I had.
So you go to the Tampa. Who is your coach for the Tampa Bay Windjammers?
Darren Morningstar. Darren Morningstar.
I know
was,
that name somehow.
Yeah, he played at Pitt. Good dude, but not ready for the responsibility of running a you know, any type of pro team, you know, even if it was the USBL, like he wasn't ready for that. So we were like driving up to Palm Beach, me and two buddies of mine, like every day we were carpooling, trying to get some money together to drive up to just be in this gym with, at the time it was probably 25 of us for maybe 2 weeks, you know, and nobody even knew what the roster was going to be. We were just going in there, and Darren was just putting us through the paces. And then he trimmed the team, even with 15, it was just as unorganized. Like, you come in, and there wouldn't be referees, and you know, I never got a check, and it was a shit show of a league.
Competition was good, and they played NBA rules, and you played against board. Here's my deal. So the next year, so in 2000, I finish, and I was the first pick of the USBL draft, right? And so we had, man, I forget the dude's name. Somebody will tweet me and remind me. But we had our coach was like a lead scout of the Dallas Mavericks. Right. Oh, and we went through training camp in Enid at Phillips University. Denny Price, who's I had worked with on my shooting, that's Brent and Mark Price's dad, was like an assistant coach. Okay. And so like we had legit dudes, you know, we had Willie Burton was on our team, was the ninth pick of the NBA draft. Right. Like he had 50 in a game for the Heat. We had Willie Burton. We had Bubba Wells, who led the country in scoring when you didn't lead the country in scoring. He did it. Right. I think Austin Peay. We had like five dudes that had at least a cup of coffee in the league. Anyway, literally the day or 2 days before the first game, like he didn't get paid or something, and he's like, "Fuck you, I quit." And Brian Gates, who Brian Gates since then, he was like a CBA coach, and he's been an NBA assistant. He's still an NBA assistant now. Like Brian Gates, like took over like his first coaching job, and like the league was nuts. But I do remember like Sean Colson was the best player in the league, and we played them. They were he was on like the Kansas Cagers or something. It's in Salina, Kansas, and I had to guard that fucker. Like we probably played him 10 times, and I mean he was really good, and it was
I couldn't guard him either. I had to guard him in the CBA. I couldn't guard him either. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, I mean he was hell of so. But my point is that in addition to it being kind of crazy, and I do think that craziness finds out like, hey, do you want to play pro basketball? Like that was my thing when I went to the FIU game and I did an FAU game on Thursday. Was I told people I was working with, I was like, hey, this seems like really shitty basketball because there's only, you know, a couple hundred people in the stands, but this is what minor league basketball is like. And, you know, I think a lot of the guys at the bigger schools, like guys I played with and, you know, Kansas guys, very, very rarely can Kansas guys or Kentucky guys or Carolina guys or Duke guys, can they survive overseas or in the minor leagues because you just got to motivate yourself. There's no crowd. There's no fancy locker room. There's no great shoes, right? There's nobody sucking you off. Like, you just got to go and hoop. And yes. And the other and oh yeah, by the way, the other guy is some guy you've never heard of in your life, like a Sean Colson, who is going to try and kick your ass and embarrass you every fucking night, right? So there is, I think there's something kind of magical to it, to those of us who've been through it, the realness of it. And you're playing against other players, but it is like everyone's, like I remember we, so the next year, the Windjammers went away. Yep. And there was a, there were two teams in Florida on that side of the coast. One was in, one was Fort Myers. And
Roy Jones was in Sarasota.
So Roy Jones yeah. owned a team in Sarasota, and then there's a team in Fort Myers. So the way it worked was, yeah, so we flew into Tampa. We drove to Sarasota, played them the next day, then drove to Fort Myers, played them back-to-back nights, drove back, played Sarasota, flew home. You know, so you're playing four games in five nights and you know, two different teams. But this is what I remember. Yeah, and you had, like, the day off you had was, like, you play, we'd play in Oklahoma, then we'd play in Dodge City, Salina, back in Oklahoma twice in a row, and we so we'd play four games, and we'd have a day off for travel. So we land in Tampa, and we have essentially kind of the day off because of travel, and we had, like, a 15-passenger van, and then, like, an SUV, and our radio guy was a guy, we actually had radio, because Oklahoma was, like, a big thing. It was before, obviously, they had the Thunder.
Right.
And our radio guy was a local radio guy that covered us at OSU. We had a bunch of, we had like five OSU guys. So we, this guy named Robert Allen, we talk him into stopping. We get a case of beer, right? We stop in Tampa, get a case of beer, pound a bunch of beers, pull up in Sarasota and hang out. And then we play Roy Jones the next day. So give me your best USB. I'm going to give you my best USBL story. It'll help jog your memory, okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
We play the Pennsylvania. We play in D.C. I don't remember the D.C. team's name. Play in D.C. And we had Darren McClinton, and then we had,
The dude's name. Wow.
Yeah, D. Clint's been on the pod. Great player. Great dude. So D. Clint was the other point guard. And then, we had one of his best friends played at West Virginia. I'll think of it in a second. Anyway, they were, you know, basically DC guys. Okay. And, so we play that night and it's crazy, like a crazy, crazy crowd because you got these DC guys coming back. We played at George Washington. So we sleep in DC and then they're like, hey, we play in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, Lehigh University. Daryl Dawkins coached the team, the Pennsylvania Valley Dogs, right? Yes. We play them the next day. And so we get up. It's like all of a sudden everybody's phone's ringing like 7 o'clock. And you know, this is when people had cell phones, but you still use, you know, you call the room. So this is 2000. So we get up and like, hey, man, we got to go. We got an early game. Like, all right, well, what do you mean early game? Like, we started at 11 o'clock. Like, what the fuck? Like, you got a bunch of grown-ass dudes who played in D.C. Everybody went, you know, all those guys, those D.C. guys went out. And we got to get up and play at 11 o'clock. All right, so we shake out the cobwebs. We meet at, like, 8. We drive a couple hours. We go all the way to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And we get there. We're like, hey, we're hungry. They're like, no problem. We'll bring you some food. So it was a special day. It was, you know, it's in the summer. So it was a day in which they wanted to fill up the arena. And they did so by getting all the local summer camps and, you know, free admission. So there's kids everywhere, you know, they got kids and balloons and a bounce house and whatever. Meanwhile, we haven't eaten shit. We just played like, you know, I don't know, 12 hours ago, not even 12, you know, whatever, 12 hours ago. So they're like, no problem. They bring like hot dogs in to the locker room, hot dogs and waters and Cokes and Snickers bars. And, you know, you're like, are you kidding me? Like, this is, like, all right. And then they start talking, you start talking yourself in. You're like, look, when I was 15, I used to go down and play at Miles Square Park and I'd eat all that shit anyway. So we go out, we play, win the game. We're flying out that night out of Philadelphia because we played in New York and whatever. And I think we got like $20 or $25 a day per diem. And they like hand you like $15. You're like, hey, man, where's the rest of my money? Like, well, no, we took out breakfast. What breakfast?
Hot dogs and Snickers.
They counted who ate how many hot dogs and took it out of your per diem. That's the USBL. All right, give me yours.
USBL, man. I had let's see. So Darren, I had a similar one with Darren Morningstar. He was there, and then he wasn't there. And, you know, like I said, I didn't get paid. So I didn't care. I was just playing basketball, still living with my parents. Apparently, Darren Morningstar had been pocketing that $25 per deal. So Darren just didn't show back up because the money never really trickled down to where it was supposed to go. But one of my favorite stories, this was my introduction into, like, grown man basketball. Do you want to do this shit, or is this not for you? Very similar trip. We go to D.C., play Yinka Dare and those guys at George Washington. Then we're going to, like, Avalon, New Jersey to play a team. We didn't get the SUV, so we had a sedan. So we were, you know, you stuff your legs in your, like, your back pocket, or you cram into this little, these little sedans, and we're on our way to New Jersey. We got in at probably, I don't know, 3:30. We were going to play, again, probably a 2 o'clock game, an afternoon game on Saturday. And I get a knock on my door at, like, you know, 15, 20 minutes after we get there. And it's one of our vets, and he bangs on the door, and I'm like, what's up, man? And he drops off of a garbage bag, and he's like, hey, I need you to take care of this. And I'm like, well, what the, take care of what? And he opens, and it's everybody's socks and uniforms and jocks and tights and you name it, it was in that fucking garbage bag. And it was my job to get up the next morning as the rook, take that shit to the laundromat, sit in the laundromat, wash it all, dry it all, have it handed back out, and then go out and start and try to score 20 the next night. And do that all the way, you know, through the Eastern Corridor as we tried to win games. And real talk to what you were saying before, like all jokes aside, that shit will weed out, like, anybody who isn't built for that life. There's no faking that. You're either on that grind and trying to prove something and wanting to make a living out of that, or you will quickly go take your 9-to-5 or what have you, because you just can't survive. And if you've been coddled at all, if there's any coddling taking place in your life, that will quickly let you know that this isn't for you. And I saw that, Doug. Like, James Cotton is a friend of mine, and he played for Shea Cotton's older brother. So by the time I got to the CBA, James had played for the Bulls. I think he had been on with the Sonics for a little bit, and all I knew was the USBL. So to be in the CBA was a step up. I was on my grind, like, happy to be there, happy for the little bit of $1,000 I made, like, happy to be on the court. When James came down, he couldn't accept it. Like, there wasn't an ability to accept not being on a chartered plane or in the Ritz-Carlton and having to share a room or taking a bus. And so he, look, after, I don't know, 2 months, he quit. It just wasn't for him, but he had a taste of something so much better that he wasn't willing to, like, recalibrate and do what he had to do to get back. So you saw that a lot coming through those minor league ranks.
Okay, Damian Owens was the, he was, I mean, he'd be like a,
Owens, if, yes.
D.O. could go, yes. Could go.
Bucket.
Okay.
Bucket.
Yeah. And honestly, like, Damian Owens was, he's like a born too soon guy, right? Like, he, right now, like, he would be a hybrid player who could guard every position. He wasn't a great, he didn't shoot it well enough for 2020 basketball, but he was nice. So we had, how about this team? So we had Damian Owens. We had LeBradford Smith, right,
wow,
who gave Jordan 31 one night. And then Galen Young, who was a second-round pick out of UNC Charlotte, right? He's a
Charlotte,
coach now.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was nice. We had Bubba Wells. We had, we had some dudes now. And I remember, and I've said this before on the podcast, and this kind of lends itself a little bit to what you're talking about, and there's another part to it. And then we also had I told you Willie Burton, and there was a couple other guys who we had. Yinka Dare was a CBA. I'll tell you that story in a second. But I remember I was talking to my dad on the phone, and I was like, we were getting ready for the first game, or it was late in training camp. I was like, Dad, we got guys that can hoop. Like, I don't even understand why Willie Burton's in the CBA. And he's like, Son, there's always a reason. And I was like, Really?
Yep.
He's like, yeah. He's like, look, there's always a reason. And I go, what do you mean? He's like, I mean, sometimes it's girls. Sometimes people, you know, they it's their weight. You know, sometimes they won't work. Some guys are just dumb. You know, guys are selfish.
Yeah.
You know, guys smoke. Yeah. Guys drink. He's like, there's always a reason why guys don't make it. It's not usually not because of talent. He's like, you know, look, you're in it because you can't shoot. Or people think you can't shoot. Like, that's it. There's always a reason why guys aren't in the league. And I remember this, and I'm not going to name names, but I remember driving to the first USBL game in the history of the Oklahoma Storm, and I get in my car from the Holiday Inn, and next to the Holiday Inn literally was a strip club. Like in the parking lot is a strip club. And we used to joke like, hey, why don't they just send your check to the strip club and cut the middleman out, right? And one of the guys who could really play wasn't in the NBA anymore. Like, his car was in the parking lot of the strip club. Like, this is like 2 hours for the game. Then I go, like, you keep going, and there's a Sonic, Sonic drive through, whatever. One of the guys who could really play was kicking back, drinking a 44-ounce Coke and eating two cheeseburgers for the game, right? And then, you know, one of the dudes was just batshit crazy. And, like, you kind of keep going on. You're like, oh, that's why they're in this league. So,
correct.
Yeah, it's okay, so you go to CBA. Where'd you play in CBA?
I played in Yakima, Washington, up there in Union Gap area. Like, it's – but I loved it. But who was on my team? Man, we had Art Long, Cincinnati. We had David Vanderpool.
Who punched a police horse. Art Long punched a police horse.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Like, how wild do you have to be to do that shit?
I don't need
you. You had me fucking. You listen.
Nobody fouls Art in practice today. Art's having a bad day. Don't foul that dude.
Art had 6 feet of a radius around his locker. Like, there was, you weren't even. It was just understood. You don't want to be near that. You just didn't know what would happen. Like, you didn't know. It was at any given time. So it was better to keep it this. David Vanderpool, really good guard. He was him and Darren McClinton from that D.C. area. Really good. Caught a lick with the Wizards for a while. Really good player.
Coach in the league.
We had Dwayne Cooper. We had a guy named Silas Mills, who was played at Utah State. Really good. I'm trying to think. Cotton came down for a while. Carlos Daniel, he's the head strength and conditioning guy at Vanderbilt now for their basketball program. We had a really good team. We won a championship that first year.
Who's your coach?
Dalen Young and all those. Paul Wuppert. Paul Wuppert, legendary coach in, I believe, Australia, and definitely in the CBA. And we just had one of those teams, Doug, where you had a lot of guys that were on the same grind, which was like, we don't want to be here, but we're here, and we're going to prove to all you guys why we shouldn't be here, right? And so we were able to weed out, for the most part, the guys that were going to be. Now, we were all, you know, we had guys that'd be in a strip club and stuff like that, but for the most part, we were all really, really hungry and in a really similar mindset and probably time in our life. So we were able to capture, you know, some magic in a year there. And it was great for me, because that shit was no illegal defenses. I mean, obviously, NBA rules, so at the time it was illegal defenses, sorry. And you had some gifted scorers. So you talked about Colson, you had Victor Page, you had guys that if you ISO'd on one side of the court and it was my job to stop you, there was no help. Like, that shit was a long night, because all they did was run Vic off of, like, a little, you know, a little horns cut. And he got you isolated on that one side of the court, and he was trying to get 50 on you. And so there were multiple guys in the CBA, Jamal Robinson, trying to think of the dudes who were getting just buckets and were really gifted with the ball. So it really made you understand that there was more to the game than what you put stock in, right? There was a lot of shit that went into playing that game, if you wanted to be a pro. And so from there, you know, all of those names that you just mentioned, what they would do with us, and you probably went through it too, is San Antonio would call you in the off season and say, hey, there's a workout, we want you to come out. Or Detroit would call you and there'd be a workout. And when you got there, you'd see 30 people from the CBA that you bumped head with all year. And you were all there to compete over a 2-day span for probably one invite to training camp. And that was it. Like, you were dropped in and they were like, hey, good luck with that shit. And they were going to watch you guys, like, beat the shit out of each other for 2 days. And see which one of you would come out alive, and they might or might not invite you to either summer league or to their vet camp. And that was CBA life.
How'd you make the league?
So I don't know how, because I too, you know, I had a great relationship with my dad, still do, and he would call and be like, "How'd it go?" And I'm like, "Well, they didn't do anything particularly great. Like, you know, their guys are to score better than me, and their guys bigger and more athletic. And Doug, I would go in there and I would just play the way I thought I was supposed to, right? I would defend my ass off. I would share the ball. All the shit that you would think to shine in a scenario like that, you wouldn't do. You think you need to take it and get 20 in. But I was discounting how good Coach Popovich and, you know, the Detroit staff, how good they were at identifying basketball players, right? Like,
I think you're reading it wrong. I think you're doing, or maybe you're being. You're underselling yourself. Like, here's the mistake that guys make when they go to the CBA or now the G League, right? Is they're like, yo, man, I got to get buckets till I get to the league. Like, hey, guess what, dude? You're in the – they have guys in the NBA that can get buckets.
They have guys that do that.
Right.
But yeah,
the guys that make – right, the guys that make $30 or $40 million a year, they get buckets. Now, look, you got to be able to make a shot. Right, you got to be able to make a shot. But can you do all, like Billy Donovan says, the 95% of the time you don't have the ball? Can you, if you're a point guard, like I tell this all the time, like I nailed the Kendall Marshall thing and Kendall Marshall's dad's like tweeting at me and I feel bad that the kid got hurt. And so, but my thing was like Kendall Marshall couldn't be a backup point guard in the league. And people didn't understand. I was like, look, when you're a backup point guard in the league, you got to pick up 94 feet. You got to change the tempo of the game. You got to be able to make a shot. You got to push the basketball. He was a great passer, but he couldn't really shoot. He couldn't really finish, and he can't really guard anybody. And in order to get the volume of assists, you have to get the volume of touches. Like that, when you're playing 10 minutes a game and you're playing against, you know, some backup point guard who's a converted two, who's just trying to come out and get by, like you can't do that. Anyway, my point is that like, dudes go to the G League or go to those workouts like, man, I'm going to get buckets. That's how I get to the league. Like, nah, dude. Like,
and it's
that,
not right.
That, right. That's the icing. If you can go one-on-one and a shot clock and get a bucket, that's great. But we have two guys that get paid $20 to $40 million that can do that. You got to guard.
Doug,
you
got
to move the ball. You got to stay out of the fucking way.
We have a whole roster of guys that can do that. We're looking for one piece. And so,
yes. But
no one explained that to me, right? So, like, I'm in there. Just doing what I think is you know, playing solid basketball while a lot of other people are doing that. And so, you know, what happens was I get that invite to vet camp because I am the one that they're like, oh shit, he'll guard somebody. You know what I mean? Or like, and it's a fascinating thing because I see it to this day and I work with a lot of high school kids, a lot of them that won't ever play, you know, in college. And I talk a lot to them about like, hey man, look, it's when you're playing on a team, it is valuable to have a role, a defined role, buy into that role, and be the best in that role that you can be. Like, not everyone can have this job. And it's unfortunate. Like, I know your mommy doesn't want to hear that, or your dad wants to take you and transfer, and I'm okay with that because everyone has to do what's best for their kid. But sometimes you got to understand what your fucking role is, and you have to play it. And so, you know, those guys that you're talking about, what I like to say about them is they were just too good for their own good, right? Like, too gifted with the ball to put value in doing anything other than having the ball in their hands. Never mind that Allen Iverson was you know, 10 times better than you'll ever be with it. You're just nice enough with it that you think it's supposed to be yours, and that's just not the reality. So, you know, I wind up getting pulled out of those CBA, like, mosh pits because I wasn't good enough with the ball to ever misconstrue it. I'm like, okay, fuck, well, I got to do something else. And so I figured out what I could do, which was defend and, you know, knock down shots.
So you get, did you go to camp and make the league, or did you get a call up and make the league?
Yeah, so I wind up going, so here's, like, I mean, we could just go on. So I wind up going to San Antonio, Summer League. They pull me out of Summer League, and Alvin Gentry is like, hey, we're shutting you down in Summer League. We're offering you a contract right now. We don't want you to go out there and try. Literally said to me, we can't have you going out there and getting a deal from anybody else, so we're going to shut you down. So I'm like, all right, cool. But I got my money, so I'm straight. So I go to vet camp. Antonio Daniels takes me out. We've cop a new Lexus. Like I'm just bugging out, right?
Wait, hold on. Lexus. You bought a new Lexus the second you got some money?
Yeah, as soon as I got it. Let's go get this Lexus.
What year is this?
This is 2001, maybe.
What Lexus?
2001. It was a GS 430, maybe. the GS430. Yep. You know, they had the GS. Yep. It was a 330 or 430.
Yeah. That was the first. So, when I first got money, I got a used version of that with some sweet rims on it. I got the same car. That car called ass. That was a great car.
That was a great car, right? So I'm like doing it. Like, I'm a spur. I'm in the hotel. We're looking for apartments. And then training camp ends, and they're like, yeah, dude, we're going to cut you. And I'm like, wait a minute. What the fuck? So they decide to keep Derek Dial because the one part that I hadn't been able to put together, Doug, was really understanding how to space the floor and where to be in pick and roll. And it was obvious when you watched me play, even in the early tape with the Sixers, like when shit was going on, I didn't know where to be. I played hard. I defended. I could do some things, but I didn't know how to just chill in the corner and lift out of the corner when I was strong. So, like, I didn't understand that yet. And so I needed that. I needed to learn how to play. So I go back to the CBA, and then I get
back to Yakima?
I go back to Yakima, right? The league folds. Not before I break my leg, though. So I go home.
How'd you break your leg?
Year. Jamel Thomas sets a blind screen on me while I'm hawking the ball 94 feet, and I couldn't get my leg out from under me. So I fall all the way over it, and I break the non-weight-bearing bone in the lower half of my left leg. So I'm back now to, is it the IBL now in Sioux Falls, South Dakota? Yeah. And I had not played a game. It's Randy Livingston. It's myself. It's Jamal Robinson and Carlos Daniel. And I have not played a game, but I'm going to suit up the next night for the first time. And I'm sitting at Denny's. We're eating breakfast, and the phone rings, and he says, hi, yeah, is Raj out there? This is Tony DeLeo from the 76ers. And my uncle is full of shit. Like, he's like, so I'm like, Uncle Chuck, stop fucking with me, man. And I hang the phone up. And so I go back to Eden, and they're like, yo, what was, I'm like, don't worry about it. It rings right back, and he's like, no, Raj, seriously, this is Tony DeLeo from the 76ers. We'd like to offer you a 10-day contract. And I was,
you hadn't
like,
played a game?
I hadn't played a game, Doug. I hadn't played a game since, I don't know, fifth, sixth game into the CBA season. So I'm like, fuck, hey, I just got called up. I get my shit, I get to Philly, and I ask Larry Brown, I'm like, yo, you know, what's the deal? He's like, look, Pepe got traded. He missed the deadline for us to be able to reacquire him, for him to make the playoff roster, so we need a body for the playoffs. And I'm really good friends with Pop. Pop said you were great in camp. He was like, look, you were, you know, you just weren't ready to play yet. He was like, but you were everything, you know, that you'd want in a guy for this spot on a team. He was my best man in my wedding. Like, we're really good friends. So he was like, if you ever get a chance to call this kid, call him. So that, Doug, like, I say this in a shorter version to kids at every basketball camp I speak at. And it's corny as shit, and no, it's cliche
it.
As
it's
hell.
Okay. It's okay.
It wasn't how I scored the ball or how big I was or how many dunks I had or assists or rebounds. What got me in the NBA was I was a good dude. I worked really hard. I impressed that impression was made on Greg Popovich, and he spoke up for me with Larry Brown, and they pulled me up. That's how I got to the NBA.
Yeah, it's you know, like, this is the thing, and we look, and I don't want to get into like a political discussion. I do think that what's always been lost in a Kaepernick thing, right, is you got to have what I call a rabbi in the room, somebody who believes in you, and
right.
Like. Look, I think Kaepernick would have been back in the league had his girlfriend not put out the meme about the Ravens owner. Why? Because Greg Roman was his offensive coordinator in San Francisco. He was in Baltimore. Like, that was his guy. That was his guy who could vouch. You have to have somebody who's going to vouch for you. And by the way, Kaepernick originally lost his job because he people didn't see him as a leader. He was aloof. He had his headphones on, if you remember, at the facility. There's all these. And anyway, the point is, like, there's a lot more. There's, like I said, there's always a reason, right? Like, nobody wants an asshole. And I this is how I say it. I'm not nearly as nice as you are. I tell college kids all the time, like, hey, look, I know you all think you're going to the league, but listen, if you're LeBron, you can be an asshole. Like, he's not, but you could be an asshole. If you're Giannis, you can be, you're so, if you're Steph, you could, none of them are, they're incredible guys, but you could be a dick and nobody's, you're so good, it doesn't matter. But if you're the 15th dude, you have to be the world's greatest human being. Every day, Pete Carril, the old Princeton coach, you want to be a light bulb, right? You want to light up every room that you walk into. Like, look, yep. That's why Scotty Brooks has been on my pod. He's the head coach. Like, why do you think Scotty Brooks made it in the league? Like, he was a great scorer in college at UC Irvine. But, like, and he was tougher than shit. You got to be tough, but then you got to be a guy that everybody loves. And that's what you were.
Absolutely.
And that's how you, right?
Absolutely.
And it wasn't until Greg Popovich swore. Okay, so you're with the 76ers. What time of year is this?
This is April, dude. This is like, I don't know, 5-6 games left in that 2001 season. So I had just got there when the playoffs started. They had to give me a second 10-day to hold me over for like 4 days until the playoffs started so I could be on their playoff roster.
So how much did you play? I mean, I'm looking at your stats. I actually know the answer. So, but anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I didn't play at all. I played in Indiana one night, I think, probably 10 or 15 minutes. Through the first round of the playoffs, we played Indy 7, I think. We played Toronto 7. And what happened was, in the Toronto series, we didn't have anybody who could guard Vince. So if you remember the series, Vince and Allen, it was like an all-time scoring, like back-and-forth series between those two. It was some of the best scoring I've ever seen or witnessed, like in person, those two from game to game kind of going back and forth, right? But within that series, NBA practices at that time of the year, nothing fucking going on. Like, you're coming out, you're walking through what happened, like, the day before. The starters aren't doing anything. So you're maybe getting some three-on-three with some of the guys that are on the bench, but probably not. So you're probably just going to go out there and get some shots up, and if there's a rookie, maybe you get to play him one-on-one. So we were doing very little. But the conversation in practice was, who can guard Vince? And, you know, I was like, you know, a little sheepish at first. I was like, I could guard him. And they were like, you know, I remember them looking at me like Larry Brown and Dave Hanners and John Kuster, just dismissive, like, yeah, right, whatever. So that series goes on. They don't play me in that series. And we have the same problem going into the Milwaukee series where it's like, all right, who can guard Ray? And, you know, I'm like, I can guard him. And so, you know, we get in a game. I think it's game 5, maybe? Game 6. Like, I don't play early in that series. We go down by, I want to say, like 25 or 26 in Milwaukee. And so at that point, they're going to clear the bench. And when they cleared the bench, we brought them all the way back to within striking distance to where they're like, all right, we're going to put the starters back in and try to close it. Now, the starters didn't close it, but it's another thing I say to these fucking kids, man. Look, you get an opportunity, just stay ready, man. Like, to the best of your ability, be ready when your number's called, because you don't know if you ever get that opportunity again. You never know. So, like, I made an impression to where they played me game 7. And when they played me game 7, Doug, I was having an out-of-body experience. Like, I come in, I get a dunk, I get a steal and a dunk, I hit a 3 out of the corner, like, I and-one Tim Thomas. I was watching it from somewhere in the stands. That's how, like, crazy this moment was for me. But that was, the rest of it was what it was. Like, they played me the rest of the finals, and then once Larry Brown fell out of love with me the next year, I barely played for Philly, but that, you know, the roller coaster of emotion, like the lowest of lows, having like been out of the CBA even with a terrible leg injury, to playing in the Eastern Conference Finals in Game 7, like the first sub off the bench, was like it's like Hollywood type shit.
So you go and you play the Lakers in the NBA Finals.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we get to the Kobe stuff, right?
Yep.
Game 1 was you guys go and steal game 1. AI scores 48. Should be pointed out, he took 41 fucking shots. Can you imagine
that's
taking 41 shots in a game?
Huh? That's of no consequence. That's of no consequence.
No. 41 shots. By the way, you were a plus 11. Not sure if you're aware. Played 19 minutes. Okay.
Yep.
What was the scouting report? Kobe struggled that game, 7 of 22. Shaq was 17 of 18. He was nasty. Shaq had 44. I mean, that's because you guys, and you guys had Mutombo, right? Like, he.
Defensive player of the year.
Right. And Shaq had 44 and 20 and 5 assists,
yeah,
and they lost. Okay, so what was the, what do you remember about the first scouting report, Kobe Bryant?
I don't remember the scouting report on Kobe. I remember watching the film on him and trying to figure out like what I could do. Because again, I didn't remember. I didn't know offense yet, so I didn't understand like the intricacies of the triangle. Like I didn't understand like I did when I was older about how I could, what spot he wanted to be at. But I just, you know, I watched the guy on film and I was like, Jesus, like, you know, this isn't a jump shooter, but this isn't a guy who can't shoot a jump shot. This is a like well-rounded scoring machine. Like, what am I going to do? And so what I decided to do was what just boilerplate, like deny the hell out of him. If I could stop him from getting the ball, wherever he went, then I stood a chance to like slow him down. It wasn't great team defensive principles, but right, at that point it was like, I was trying to survive.
My dad was a college coach, coached some professionally, but then he became this AU coach, and it's the same flat. Like, and I'm always fascinated that so many people don't employ this philosophy, which is like, hey, when push comes to shove, just deny the guy the ball. You cut down the number of possessions he gets the ball. You're already kind of winning there, right? Like
you're
that's
winning.
Because
yeah.
They're like, fuck it, I'll go the other way. I mean, and the triangle, right. Which I know you know really well now, I got a chance. I was with the Lakers in their summer league and in three of their vet mini camps and free agent mini camps, whatever. So, and my dad coached under Tex. And the triangle is based upon where the ball moves. Like there's a defined movement and spacing based upon the one pass, the two passes, you know, the three pass. And it's amazing that, like, look, if you just deny him the ball and they have other guys, they'll pass it to somebody else.
Correct. And someone else is going to shoot it. And so that's where that's the space I found myself in early with Kobe. And it was just like, let's try to keep it out of his hands and see what we can do with it. The problem with that was like after game one, I don't remember what the numbers were. I remember feeling like, yeah, you did a good job. Like, not really feeling yourself, but feeling proud of the job that you had done, and it led to a win. And then the rest of it was downhill, bro. It wasn't. Yeah, you were in trouble after that.
I know I want to talk. I want to make this mostly about Kobe, but that was obviously the game in which AI made the shot over Ty Lue and stepped over him. What was AI like?
Oh, AI was a special one, brother. Look, no, all jokes aside. Hey, listen.
Oh, shit.
Listen, man. I knew that as a second-year player that I had to get to the hotel, get everybody's bags, and help get that shit out. And if I could be back down in the lobby within an hour, everyone would have done what they needed to do, and then they'd be congregating back in the lobby to get into a limo to go to wherever the party was that night. And it was every city you went to. So I just had to hustle to get my shit, get everybody's shit passed out, and then back down to the lobby so I could be a part of like whatever was going on that night. And it was every city we went to. But he took care of everybody. And not just like not a financial thing, but if you were his rook, he was making sure you were looked out for, right? Like his boys and people that rolled with him, he was making sure everything was taken care of. Like he was a phenomenal teammate. As a player, an older player, it would have been probably a little frustrating for me to play with him because you just barely got the ball. If you did, it was like late in the shot clock, and you know, he was brilliant, but I wouldn't have loved that. Just full, like, being honest, like as an older player, I wouldn't have loved that. But for where I was in my career, it was great, and you know, I had some good times playing with AI, man.
He was a special one. I love that. I never forget he was Bubba Chuck when we played against him. I was at Notre Dame, and we started five white dudes. And my boy Antoni Weiss, who's now an assistant at Siena, he checks into the game, and one of our guys, somebody's shooting free throws, and it's me, Bubba Chuck or AI and Tone, and we're like sandwiching him. They're shooting free throws. Game's on Big Monday, and he goes, "Yo, man, what's up with all the white dudes at Notre Dame?" He goes, "Five? Really, five?" He's like, "I've never seen some shit like that." I go, "Oh, you are in Indiana." He was funny. He was a funny dude.
Yeah, he was a riot.
Because you went to Dallas and you became a starter, okay? But it wasn't really until you went to Utah. But between Dallas and then Utah, even before Phoenix, you know, now you're playing against Kobe. I don't know how many times you guys play. It seemed like 10 times a year.
Yeah.
When did it start to become a thing between the two of you?
Yeah, it started to heat up in probably my second year in Utah and my first stint in Utah when I was – he knew that I was going to be out there, right? Like, this wasn't like you might see Raj tonight, you might not see him. Like, but I was going to be there, and I was starting to feel myself to the point where it wasn't just happy to be there anymore. It wasn't happy to be guarding Kobe anymore. It was like, I want some of that smoke. Like, I want to – like, let's go. Now, you know, I was never going to be able to do any of the things that he did. But the inner competitor in me had passed the point of being, like, happy to be there. I was now ready to, like, let my full competitive, you know, like, self come out. And so that's when it started to get a little testy. That second year, he and I got in the dust up, like, right across from our bench. I think he hit me with an elbow in the face and like, kind of, you know, one of those where you're in triple threat and you're just taught to, like, you know, if I'm crowding your space, you're gonna swing through and make me back up, you know? And so he clipped me, like, right under my eye, and, you know, I motherfucked him, and we got, you know, the refs had to get involved. And that particular game was one, because I think, like, after I got hot, he said something to the refs. I had, like, 20-something in the game against him, right? And I don't know who won the game, but I remember it was one of my better scoring performances against him. And
who's this with, Dallas or with Utah?
Utah. This is with Utah. And at that point, I then knew, all right, like, I'm never going to be disillusioned to think that I'm like that. But I'm here to compete. Every time I see him, I want to compete. And that's kind of when it took off. And then when we got to Phoenix, the whole thing just blew up. It took on a life of its own that first year.
Okay, so this is where, and I did a pod where I talked a little bit about what became my relationship with him. But
right.
And I was under the impression, you tell me I'm wrong. I was under the impression that a lot of dudes in the NBA, especially, you know, for a good portion of his career, didn't like him. Is that wrong? Am I mistaken? Like, what was his? What were other guys? Because now he's even before his death, like, he was revered. What was his? By the way, you had 26 in that game. If you want to know,
there you go.
You guys did lose. You took the L.
Right.
It was in L. Is that the game in LA you're talking about?
In LA, yes, sir.
Okay, it was March 28th of 2014. You were 9 of 17 from the floor. You got 17 shots up. Damn, dog.
Yeah, hey, got my jacks up. That was
no, you were getting your jack up. That year, you were getting shots.
That's right.
6 of 10 from the line, though. What was going on? I mean, you could have had even more. But, you know, you were a plus +7, so it's not your fault that your team lost. Kobe was 8 of 23. He got 21 free throws. Damn, dude, 21 free throws.
Yeah.
He got taken care of.
Yeah,
that was the year they lost it. That was, listen to their lineup. This team did not win the NBA championship. Shaq, yeah. Kobe, Karl Malone, Gary Payton, and Rick Fox. That was their starting lineup.
That's right.
And they brought Derek Fisher off the bench, and Kareem Rush, Slava Medvedenko, Luke Walton, Devin George,
right.
Brian Russell, and Brian Cook. That's what you call a top heavy roster. Anyway, they beat you. They beat you on that. You guys had AK-47. Your boy, Carlos Arroyo, right?
Yes, sir.
Jaren Collins, Gordon Giracek, and you had Googs on your team, Tom Gugliotta. You came off the bench with Raul Lopez, Mikey Moore, Sasa Pavlovich, and Ostertag, Michael Ruffin, and Mo Williams played a minute.
We were fucking stacked, brother. Stacked.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
All right, that's it for part one of my Kobe / Rajah Bell talk with Rajah Bell. Okay, stay tuned for part two. We're not going to wait a whole week. We'll drop that sucker tomorrow, the next day, or whatever. We'll figure it out. But I thought you'd enjoy it. Just a quick programming note. The Doug Gottlieb Show is every day 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific. And, of course, you can download the Doug Gottlieb Show podcast. That's where you'll have up-to-date information and stories and commentary on the trades that are made or are not made and what it means for the league. Anyway, look, the new one's going to pop up in your queue very, very soon. But tell a friend to download this one, and they'll get the next one as well. I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks so much for downloading. Don't forget to rate and review us. It does. I'm told it helps us. Just do it. If you liked it. If you didn't like it, it's okay. You can rip it. Fine. Whatever. I don't know if that hurts us. Probably does. But if that makes you feel better, good. I guess. Thanks for listening. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.